This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. An insular, large town. That's how historian Stephen Puglio says Boston began the second half of the 19th century. But it ended it as one of the Western world's major cities. In those 50 years, Boston built the Back Bay, the continent's first subway system, rail connections to distant cities. It also led the abolitionist cause and helped win the Civil War for the Union. And in all that, it quadrupled its population through immigration and annexation. So for Boston, the middle of the 19th century was an unprecedented run of growth and progress. You may know Stephen Puglio from his previous work chronicling the history of Boston's Italian immigrants and for his book Dark Tide about the North End Molasses Flood. His latest book is called A City So Grand, The Rise of an American Metropolis, Boston, 1850 to 1900. Stephen Puglio, welcome to Radio Boston.
Welcome. Thank you, Meghna. Great to be here.
Well, let me just start by asking you, we think of Boston as being a pretty important place at the start of American history, of course, due to the American Revolution. But you're focusing on the 19th century. And one of our producers, Adam Ragusa, dug up some numbers for me. He found that, you know, according to the 1850 census, Boston was already the third largest city in the country behind New York and Baltimore. But it was still, in your mind, a pretty marginal place. Why?
Yeah, I mean, marginal might not be quite the right word, but it is a what I consider kind of a large town. Did it have influence? Yes, from the Revolution particularly, and from some of the great writers in the 1830s and 1840s. But it is basically a large town in terms of its attitude, in terms of its population, in terms of its physical geography. And by the end of that 19th century, by the dawn of the 20th century, it's as large and as influential as any great city in the world, including New York, London, Paris, probably the big three at the time.
Mm-hmm. So let's draw our timeline into how that happened. You really begin in 1851 and the abolitionist movement, starting with the Thomas Sims fugitive slave case. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the abolitionist movement to me really kind of propels this whole era. The Thomas Sims case, kind of a shameful, embarrassing case in Boston's history, particularly from the abolitionist standpoint, when Boston sends its first fugitive slave back to captivity in April of 1851. The fugitive slave law called for northern cities to return captured slaves to captivity. Boston does that after many, many efforts by the abolitionists to prevent it. And it really kind of galvanizes the abolitionist movement. They're quite ashamed at the results of the Sims case. And I think that kind of propels the movement into the leading abolitionist movement in the country.
So how is it that the abolitionist movement then, I mean, makes Boston itself a bigger, more vibrant, you know, American metropolis?
Yeah, I think the abolitionist movement kind of starts that process. Boston becomes, there were great abolitionist movements in New York and Rhode Island and Pennsylvania and Ohio, but Boston really becomes the leader of that movement. All eyes kind of look to the city. The city kind of, I think, gets this level of confidence that begins with that abolitionist movement that propels it into some of these other great areas. It's railroad prowess, the first public library in the country in Boston. The first compulsory education law happens in the 1850s in Boston. The Back Bay Project happens in the late 1850s in Boston. So I think the abolitionist movement kind of propels that and begins that whole phenomenon.
So a lot of social development really springboards off of that.
Absolutely.
Well, but you know, it's interesting because maybe a slightly less dramatic event that you point to in almost in that same time is the Great Boston Railroad Jubilee in 1851, a multi-day celebration of the completion of rail lines connecting Boston with Montreal and Chicago. Why? I mean, this was the great age of railroads anyway, so why is this one so particularly important?
I think from Boston's standpoint, in terms of its economic development, the city kind of boasts. Once it developed railroad traffic to Chicago and Montreal, that was kind of its big claim to fame. It boasted that you could ship goods from Liverpool, England to Montreal, Canada, via Boston, and once it got off the ships at the port via train to Montreal, faster than you could do it from anywhere else, including New York. And so there was a New York-Boston rivalry even then. And it kind of sets the tone for Boston's railroad prowess during this period. They formed shorter railroad trips from Boston to the suburbs. They charged passengers reduced fares. They called them commuted fares. The word commuter starts in Boston in 1852. Appropriately, I think, with the commute that we have. And so that really begins Boston's leadership in the railroad business in the 1850s.
Okay, there's another aspect of rail travel that we're going to talk about in just a minute in terms of subway systems emerging from here in Boston. But really the big achievement, or the next really big one that you point to, is the filling of Back Bay, which begins in earnest in 1858 or so.
1857, 1858.
So the way you describe it, the project is very similar to the Big Dig. It's huge, it's long-term, it disrupts the city, except in this case, developers actually make money.
Well, it's wildly successful, first of all. It's on time, even though it's a 35-year project, it's on time. And not only developers make money, everybody makes money, including the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The Big Dig makes the Back Bay makes about a $3.5 million profit, half of which goes back into a Commonwealth education fund. So it is really a marvelous financial coup, as well as a technological and engineering coup.
But was the filling in of Back Bay really just sort of a real estate development project for Boston's wealthier people?
You know, one of the reasons for the development of the neighborhood itself was to keep some of the wealthy people in the city, within the city limits, with the arrival of thousands of destitute Irish immigrants who were crowding into old Boston. So, yeah, one of the visions of this neighborhood was to set up a wealthy, fashionable, prestigious residential neighborhood called the Back Bay that was quite separate from old Boston, everything on the other side of the public garden in the Boston Common, if you will, which is why the Back Bay is set up, you know, in kind of a grid form today, much, much different than the old city. And yes, that was at the heart of the vision. Wealthy folks needed to stay in Boston, according to city fathers, for a lot of reasons. And philanthropy was a big reason, investment, that sort of thing. And so that was at the heart of it, for sure.
I guess what I'm asking is because it's almost heretical to even ask it today, because you can't imagine the city without Back Bay. But, you know, we're celebrating a development for, like you said, for Boston's sort of bluer bloods. But you're saying that keeping them in the city actually was good for the city of Boston as a whole and its continued development.
Absolutely. I mean, all the investment that we're talking about, all of the, you know, contributing to things like the Boston Public Library and the arts and education, much of that came from, you know, kind of this wealthy philanthropic community. That was in jeopardy early in the 1850s, in the mid-1850s. The Back Bay Project, not to mention the whole pollution issues in the Back Bay. So you did have wealthy people fleeing from the city of Boston. And this is, I think, kind of almost an ingenious way to keep them in the city and at the same time help the city as a whole.
Hmm. Well, so now we move forward a little bit in our little timeline to a kind of a bump in the road that Boston hits in 1872. I believe that year started pretty promising. I mean, the Boston Globe publishes its first issue.
Yes, it does.
March 4th. But then there's a smallpox epidemic that hits in the spring. 200 people die in the North End, 700 people in the rest of the city. And then in November, a great fire. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, an enormous fire, really. Burns most of what is today's present-day financial district. So if you go from the old South Meeting House all the way to the waterfront, is essentially burned. Buildings explode. It's really quite a terrible fire. And Boston, right after that fire, does this remarkable job of rebuilding, tremendous resilience on the part of the city. They improve water flow in the area. They improve gas flow and gas shutoff mechanisms in the area. They improve hydrant systems in the area. And by about 1874, 1875, right at the halfway point of this era that we're talking about, there's very little evidence even that there's been a Great Boston Fire, and yet it was a monumental fire. So pretty impressive in a very short time.
Wow. And Boston bounces back very strongly.
Very strongly.
Hmm. Hmm. Well, so now near the end of the 19th century, 1897, one of my favorite aspects of what you've highlighted here in Boston's 19th century history, and that is the opening of the one block of the subway line between Park Street and Boylston. If you go to Park Street Station today, you see on the MBTA, on the Green Line, there's, you know, a little display talking about the opening of the Park Street Under, I believe they called
it. That's what it was called.
So what in your mind makes this one block of a subway system so great, especially because I looked up that, say, the London Underground by the 1860s had already had quite a extensive underground system, and we got one block of it in 1897.
We got one block, but it's the first block in America, and I think that was really a huge deal for Boston. The city actually takes a chance on this kind of technology, and it wasn't without controversy. Tremendous amount of controversy about going underground, leaving the earth, as it were, to travel, both because there were health and fears about health and rats and rodents underneath, and sort of fears of this nether world that you were going underneath the earth to travel. And so it was kind of a controversial issue. The citizens of Boston only vote 15,000 to 14,000 to approve the subway when the vote is held. But Boston does decide to go ahead and do it, and it is the first one. And they beat New York again as part of that rivalry that even existed at that time. But you're right, to that point, only London, Glasgow, and Budapest were the only places with subways.
Well, we're talking with Stephen Puglio. He's author of A City So Grand, The Rise of an American Metropolis, Boston, 1850 to 1900. Stephen Puglio, overall, what was happening? What is it about the makeup of the people of the city of Boston that makes these 50 years in the mid-19th century so active, so much of a period of growth for the city?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it is a period, I think, when Boston really no wasn't part of her vocabulary. She accomplished so much. And I think there is this sort of feeling or this sort of period of real, I guess, commonwealth. And I don't necessarily mean that as in sort of a big government way. It was government, and there was private sector, and there were average citizens who all kind of took part in this sort of collective vision, or I guess the collective good of the city, and it really, I think, catches on. It doesn't mean there weren't problems. There were huge issues during this period of time in the city, but for the most part, the city has, it may sound a little corny, but the city has very much a can-do attitude. Mm-hmm. Something that I think contrasts a lot with today.
Well, actually, exactly on that point, you know, earlier in the show I referenced that there is a gaping hole in Downtown Crossing where the Filene's used to be. Who knows when that's going to be filled with something that we can be proud of. So, you know, how is it that you think that Boston can recapture that spirit that it had in the 19th century?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is kind of getting back to this sort of collectivism and this sort of let's try to do something for the common good. And I think one of the things that prevents that in some cases is this kind of very fractured sort of media, hyper-intensive media sort of environment that we're in, where a very small number of people can stop a project in its tracks with protest. You can find just about anybody to protest anything. I think that's kind of a...
It's the American way. That's democracy.
Isn't that a maxim? Yes. But I think those people get sort of influence beyond their numbers in the sort of environment that we're in now. And so there's this hesitancy, I think, of leaders to kind of take the lead and make that kind of thing happen. And I think that's one of the huge issues that I see in these kinds of projects, whether it's Downtown Crossing or Fan Pier or any of the big projects at Boston, the Rose Kennedy Greenway, you know, any of the big project that Boston is considering. We run into that issue, I think.
Well, I suppose Boston leaders would do well to look to your book for examples on how leadership can get things done in the city. Stephen Puglio, author of A City So Grand, The Rise of an American Metropolis, Boston, 1850 to 1900. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Magda.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from TheAngle@Boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.